Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. A more fitting title for this week's podcast might be The Year Ahead in Ukraine, or at least the months ahead. We're going to talk about what may happen in Russia's war against Ukraine in 2025, including the prospects for peace. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Sam Green, Director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, or CEPA, and a professor at the King's Russia Institute at King's College London. Thank you very much for joining me, Sam.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
All right. It's great to have you on the podcast again. Now, last time we spoke was shortly after U.S. President Joe Biden withdrew his reelection bid. In fact, I think it was before Kamala Harris became the Democratic candidate. Since then, of course, former President Donald Trump defeated Harris in the November election and is set to take office for a second time on January 20th. Time flies. Trump said many times during the campaign that he could broker an end to the war within a day or two if elected. But he said little about how he would go about that. And there is now constant talk about potential peace plans, along with reports saying that Trump has not settled on any particular approach as yet. And there are also many high hurdles to any push for peace. I'm not going to go into all of them now, but one major question is whether Russian President Vladimir Putin and Russia would accept any plan or even any conditions to just begin talks that would also be acceptable at the outset for Ukraine and its supporters. Sam, what do you think? Will there be substantive peace talks in the coming months? And if there are, what would you say about the chances for a peace agreement in 2025? So I should probably add the chances for a peace agreement or for a ceasefire, which is not the same as a peace agreement, of course. What will you be watching for in terms of signs about which way the war is headed as 2025 unfolds?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you made that distinction, because I think I don't see much in the prospect for a peace plan. If what we mean by peace is a durable end to the war, not just a reduction or an elimination of the fighting, but actually an agreement between a sovereign Ukraine and a sovereign Russia that ends the conflict and puts both parties on course towards normalization, which is what we think of in terms of a peace treaty. Right? I don't see that being available. I don't see any Russian regime that involves Vladimir Putin or anybody who identifies himself as a direct successor to Vladimir Putin as being interested in that. We can talk about why that might be, but I also don't see that really being available to the Ukrainians until Russia can see its way to restoring Ukraine's full territorial sovereignty and integrity and making some kind of reparations for the damage caused in this war, to say nothing of accountability for war crimes. Assuming that all of that is off the table, I think that what we may be looking at, what we will likely be looking at, is some de facto, at least if not a de jure, ceasefire with some degree of negotiation, tacit or explicit, over the course of 2025. That seems to be where a lot of the parties are headed in their thinking. Certainly something that, as you said, the Trump administration is interested in, really without saying much about, you know, what their own conditions and red lines might be. The fact that that creates uncertainty for both the Ukrainians and for the Europeans in terms of the level of support that Ukraine can expect from Washington means that I think it becomes much more difficult for Kyiv and for Kyiv supporters in Europe to see their way to a significant improvement over the course of 2025 in Ukraine's standing on the battlefield, which again I think does privilege some kind of a process that would lead to a solidification of the line of control and probably a reduction in the amount of fire going across that line in in both directions. Can Russia see its way to that? I think they will be very reluctant to talk about it publicly because talking about it publicly begins to create sort of a sense of potential binding obligation and allows parties, including, within the Russian system, including to some extent the Russian population, but also importantly parts of the Russian elite, to begin to calculate their gains and losses with regard to some kind of a potential ceasefire. So I think that if Moscow is going to engage in these conversations, it will be very, very quiet. And we will only really find out about what's on the table once all parties have agreed on something. But I think it will be difficult for Moscow to agree to something that does not leave it with effective control of escalation, right? So Moscow will want to retain the power of initiative, the ability to push against that line, to renew the fighting without facing significant consequences, which of course is the opposite of what the Ukrainians need to see. So if the Ukrainians are going to sign up to any kind of a ceasefire, it really depends not on the negotiations between Kyiv and Moscow, but on the negotiations between Kyiv and Western countries, those countries that can provide some kind of a guarantee, some kind of a physical deterrent against renewed Russian aggression. If Western countries can provide that, and I think we're seeing some discussion, including between the French and the British, about putting an actual force along the line of control, if they can provide that, and if they can get Moscow to a position where they will agree to that. I do think that might be the kind of thing that Ukraine could sign up to, again, as a ceasefire, not as a peace deal. So not as acquiescence to permanent Russian control of sovereign Ukrainian territory, but as a way of reducing the cost that this war continues to impose on the Ukrainian people.
Thanks, Sam. I'm just gonna try to ask a couple of follow-up questions to that. You mentioned, I guess one question is, and this is a broader one, I guess, but you mentioned you don't see Russia under Putin or a successor, I believe you said, kind of looking for or agreeing to any kind of a permanent peace, and you said you could. Can you sort of explain why you think that, if that's an accurate description of what you're saying?
So when I said successor, what I meant was a successor who identifies himself, and it's probably a him and not a her, right? As a successor of Putin, right? Somebody who, to one degree or another, sees themselves as continuing Putin's rule, maybe with some modifications, but who does not identify themselves as a revolutionary of any kind. Because Russia has now written something like 20% of Ukrainian territory into the Russian Constitution. And so to undo that, right, to get to a point where Russia could pursue normalization with Ukraine would require not just repudiating the war and not just deciding that it can somehow, peel the Russian economy and the Russian system of political control away from the war, which in and of itself will be difficult. But it would require rewriting the Russian Constitution. It would require really a sea change in politics under repudiation, not just of the war, repudiation of Putin and of Putinism itself, which I think will be very difficult for most successors of Putin to accomplish, given how much support there has been in the Russian public for this war and for Putin himself.
Okay, thanks. That's a great explanation. And I guess a somewhat more specific question goes over a couple of things you mentioned. You just said Russia has written these regions, Ukrainian regions, into its constitution as parts of Russia. Obviously, few, if anyone, accepting that. But four regions, well, Crimea, five regions, including Crimea, in full. So one question, I have is, with Russia being kind of a question mark in terms of talks for even just a ceasefire, I guess I'm going to ask about two things and whether you think there's kind of any chance that Russia could accept them, at the outset of talks. One is these regions. Obviously, Russia is claiming Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson regions in their entirety as Russian. And Putin has mentioned that. They've mentioned that several times, that this is sort of the facts on the ground, although in fact it's not really the facts on the ground, because Russia does not control those regions in their entirety. So sorry, my question is whether you think there's a way that Russia could start talks without some kind of with just recognition that for the time being it controls what it controls, but not those parts of those four regions that it doesn't control.
I do think it's possible. Again, not peace talks, but a ceasefire talks. I do think that Putin and the Kremlin in general has given itself a significant amount of rhetorical wiggle room. They can define victory, even temporary victory, partial victory, in a number of different ways. As I said, also, the Russian economy right now, right, is only functioning because of the war. The Russian political system is now built around the war. It excuses and explains the level of centralization, the level of repression, the level of ideological control, which are going to be things that the Kremlin will be very loath, if able at all, to countenance pivoting away from. And so even if Russia were to pivot towards a ceasefire, I think it would find itself seeking to maintain the level of confrontation that it currently has with Ukraine, but with the West more broadly. So even if that doesn't mean a hot shooting war, it means keeping the system really very much on a war footing. And in that respect, having what Russia will see essentially as an irredentist claim against Ukraine, right? Having pieces of what Russia will call sovereign Russian territory temporarily occupied by Ukraine, right? In the Russian framing of that, will help to justify that war footing that I think, again, in the event of a ceasefire, Russia will seek to maintain for the foreseeable future. So I don't see that as being necessarily problematic for Russia's ability to turn down the violence.
Interesting. I hadn't actually thought of it that way. So now just one other follow-up on this is maybe I should apologize for focusing on Russia so much and not on Ukraine, but another big obstacle seems to be, and you mentioned, is the West ready to provide some kind of security guarantees, such as, troops on the ground in the event of a ceasefire? And obviously Russia has spoken out against this. So that's my second question. Is there any way you see that Russia could accept that as part of an agreement? And again, not for a peace, but for a ceasefire.
Well, look, Russia in various ways has spoken out against the entire concept of a ceasefire, and I wouldn't take that too terribly seriously, right? So we've seen Peskov speak about it, we've seen Zakharov speak about it, we've seen Lavrov speak about it, we've seen, Konstantin Malafeyev was in the news not too long ago talking about, there's no point in talking about Ukraine, what we need to talk about is a new Yalta and the European security architecture in general. I think these are tactics made designed to make calculations a little bit more difficult in the West and to sort of complicate the kinds of conversations that you and I get to have. But they may be very different from the sorts of conversations that the Kremlin has when it thinks nobody is looking. So I wouldn't put too much stock in those sorts of denials. But I do think that, for reasons I mentioned earlier, the Kremlin will not want to see Western troops, NATO troops in particular, along that line of control, policing a ceasefire. The reason being that, as I said, Russia will want to maintain the power of initiative. It will want to be the one controlling the dial when it comes to escalation. It will want to be able to keep everybody else, including the Ukrainians and the West, off balance. And if it has to risk shooting at NATO troops along that border, it makes that calculation of re-escalation much, much more difficult. That's an excellent reason for the Ukrainians to want to see Western troops there, and it's an excellent reason, I think, for NATO to want to be there in the event of a ceasefire. The question is, will they be able to force Moscow into a position where it doesn't have a choice but to accept that kind of an arrangement?
Okay, thanks very much. So that sort of sounds like a big a big obstacle. Now, I'd like to, I guess, switch gears here a bit. The second thing I wanted to ask you about, it's one specific factor in the talk about peace or the talk about talks, and that's public opinion. You've written interesting things about public opinion, and in late November, an edition of your newsletter focused on a poll conducted earlier that month by a group called Russian Field. In the telephone survey of 1,600 Russians, 53% of respondents told Russian Field that Russia should negotiate, while 36% said it should keep fighting its war against Ukraine. You pointed out that this was the highest result for negotiations and the lowest result for keep fighting since the beginning of Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Now, I'd be interested in your take on that specific poll if you want to go into it. But more broadly, I wonder if you could talk about public opinion in both Ukraine and Russia, and maybe even in the West as well. Sorry to make this so broad. But basically, how or to what degree public opinion could affect the course of the war from this point on.
Right. So complicated set of questions there. When we're looking at Russian public opinion, first of all, we always have to be a little bit careful in interpreting the polls. But we have seen now a very similar result come out of Russian Field, out of Chronicles, that polling project, as well as a number of surveys by the Levada Center. They're all pointing in this direction, and so I do think it is reflecting something that is happening out there in Russian public opinion, reasonably accurately. However, that's not the same thing as saying that we're now seeing a demand from the Russian public for peace. What we are seeing is a willingness to see the Russian government negotiate, the willingness to give them the space to do that. So clearly, right, the Russian public will not hold Vladimir Putin's feet to the fire to make sure that he achieves exactly the military objectives and the political objectives that he set out in his speeches in February 2022, right, as a way of ending the war. They will give him the leeway to do that. By the same token, the Russian public will not hold Vladimir Putin's feet to the fire to achieve negotiated solutions. So if Putin decides that what he wants to do is keep fighting, Russians, I think, are more or less willing to go along with that as well. In fact, I would say they're more than willing to go along with that. What we should not do is interpret these data to mean that there is now a demand for peace. There is a readiness for it. But most Russians seem to remain in this stance of trying to keep the war as far away from their lives as possible. By and large, the Russian government is allowing them to do that. And so it's sort of an equilibrium that seems to suit everybody. But if we look at other things in the polls, right, what we see, for example, is that a vast majority of Russians think that the war is going pretty well. A vast majority of Russians support the war and support the activities of the Russian military. A vast majority of Russians say that the war and the sanctions and the economic situation really aren't bothering them that very, very much, even though we know what's going on in the Russian economy. And we can see in other polls people be, very, worried about inflation, cost of living, and sort of broader trends in their quality of life and the performance of the economy. What I think we're seeing is that there is still a lot of political pressure and a lot of social pressure on people to be very much on the same page when they talk about the war, when they talk about the military, when they talk about how they think Vladimir Putin is doing, whether the country is going in the right direction or in the wrong direction. All those sorts of things are sort of ideological markers, right? We see that opinions on those things really don't vary much by, whether people live in big cities or small towns, whether they're rich or poor, whether they're old or young, right? Despite the fact that, most opinions we would expect to vary based on those kind of demographic factors. But we do see that this question on whether it's better to fight or whether it's better to negotiate an end to the war do, in fact, vary quite considerably based on age, based on gender, and based on social class, which suggests to me that, A, there's a bit more differentiation going on within Russian society on this particular point. But that because the Russian government itself has not really been clear about how it sees the end to this war, it hasn't given the public a lot of ideological markers in terms of what page they need to be on. As a result, the social and the political pressure to be on that page is a little bit looser. for that particular point, which again brings me back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of the leeway that the Russian government does have to seek a negotiated ceasefire, if not a peace deal. The Russian public, at the very least, will not be an obstacle to that. Now, when it comes to other publics, you know, I'm not an expert on Ukrainian public opinion. We have seen, however, you know, consistent support for the idea that Ukraine does need at some point to regain its full sovereignty and territorial integrity. There is not, broadly speaking, a willingness to make compromise in the mid to the long term. But I do think we are seeing a little bit more of a robust public conversation in Ukraine about the costs that this war is imposing in the short term, and the best ways of dealing with those costs. But again, I think we're seeing, you know, the Ukrainian government, we're seeing Zelensky and his team paying very close attention to the public, making sure that they are on the same page with the Ukrainian public at every step in the way. And again, critical to that, and the Ukrainian. So I have, I think, pretty clear about this in their communication with the West, is the necessity of getting robust support from the West when it comes to security for Ukraine after some kind of a ceasefire. I think it will be very difficult for the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian public to be expected to make significant sacrifices in the absence of that kind of a security arrangement. That we've been talking about from Western countries. When it comes to Western publics, again, look, the West is not monolithic on this. You know, we did not see Ukraine play very much of a role, if any role at all, in the US presidential election. But by the same token, we haven't seen, you know, the Trump administration feel like it has a great sense of really where the American public is on this war. The administration itself, as it's taking shape, seems to be all over the map on this war, and they can't decide whether they want to simply negotiate an end or whether they want to de-escalate by escalating it, which we've seen some members of the administration say. And I think the American public will wait to see what direction the administration goes. I think Europeans, by and large, are increasingly nervous about the implications that's going to have for them, and that includes both governments and voters. They are nervous about their ability to keep supporting Ukraine in the absence of robust American aid and consistency of American policy, but they're also nervous about what happens to European security if, in fact, Washington does abandon Ukraine and abandons the Europeans to solve the Ukraine problem and the Russia problem on their own. And so I think we are seeing, in some quarters, at least here in the UK, where I am at the moment, for example, you know, increasing pressure on the government to work with its European allies to bolster Ukraine, but also to bolster European security against Russia, in the absence of that reliability from Washington.
Okay, Sam, thanks very much. A lot to take in, and looks like, you know, again, it sounds like security for Ukraine, security assurances or guarantees, is a crucial part of whatever will happen in the coming year. And I appreciate your comments on all these aspects of this war. So thank you very much. We're going to wrap it up here, and appreciate your joining me, Sam.
Thank you. Always good.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Sam Green, Director of Democratic Resilience at SIPA and a professor at the King's Russia Institute at King's College London. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.